Welcome to The Taxcast from the Tax Justice Network. 15 to 20 minutes of global news and analysis on tax havens and corruption you won't hear anywhere else. With me, Naomi Fowler. The Taxcast is available to everyone for download and broadcast on www.tackletaxhavens.com. This month, tensions are rising once again between Spain and the UK over the disputed territory of Gibraltar. Leaving aside fishing rights, the militarily strategic location and unpopular recession-hit governments, Gibraltar's busily sucking out tax revenue from both countries. Spain wants to charge a €50 border tax for those coming in and out of Gibraltar to Spain. That's about $67 a time. Spain's also threatening tax investigations into thousands of Gibraltar residents. Both Spain and the UK want to change the rules so they can increase taxes on the online gambling companies based there. More on that later. Most people would agree that development money, aid and investment should be transparent. So why is the private arm of the British government's aid programme investing in developing countries through tax havens like Mauritius, Cayman Islands, Luxembourg and Vanuatu? According to the Guardian newspaper, nearly 50% of its aid investments were made through tax havens last year. Award-winning investigative journalist Richard Brooks.
The consequences are not great for the use of that money because they open up a world of tax avoidance opportunity for one thing, using those tax havens. And for another, it means that the flows of money and the yield from those investments is secret. You can't follow the money.
We'll have more on that later. The virtual currency Bitcoin is under the tax spotlight this month. The US Senate has launched an investigation into how it can be regulated. And Germany's recognised Bitcoin as a currency, meaning it can now tax Bitcoin transactions. Companies using it commercially, though, still need to apply for special permission. Norway's just finished a review of its own lending to developing countries. It's the first creditor nation to look at whether its lending practices were irresponsible. The Norwegian Coalition for Debt Cancellation has called on Norway to take creditor responsibility for Indonesia and Egypt's debts and cancel them unilaterally and unconditionally. Much of Indonesia's money went offshore and was never recovered. In Kenya, governors in individual counties want the powers to be able to offer tax incentives to investors to attract more investment. But the revenue authority thinks Kenya would be worse off, making revenue collection harder and the tax gap wider. And finally, Russian officials and their families have been banned from having foreign bank accounts. It's supposed to combat corruption. But not to worry, tax havens everywhere offer plenty of ways for them to hide their money anonymously. And those are the Taxcast headlines for this month. Now we're going to talk to the director of the Tax Justice Network, John Christensen, for his take on the month's events. Right, John, we've seen some new tensions rising over Gibraltar between Britain and Spain. I'm interested in what's not really being reported by the mainstream media in terms of how Gibraltar's tax haven status affects what's happening. Gibraltar's an offshore banking centre, gambling centre. It's accused of being soft on money laundering, contraband. What's your view on it?
At face value, this appears to be a relatively minor issue about fishing rights between Spain and Britain. But below the surface, this is actually a much deeper tension. Of course, the Gibraltar-Spain tensions involving the UK goes back centuries to the Treaty of Utrecht. But the real issue here actually is long-term tensions around Gibraltar's emerging role. It's been a tax haven for a very, very long time. But in recent years, since 2011, they've adopted a new tax regime with a notional rate of 10%. But that regime, which is based around a territorial tax system, is in some respects taking Gibraltar in the direction of where Ireland is positioned, with similar residence rules as you have in Ireland. And the Spanish authorities are clearly worried about this because they're losing tax revenue, they're likely to lose even more tax revenue. So what appears to be a minor spat involving Britain and Spain over fishing issues is in fact a deeper and very much more tense thing involving Gibraltar's role as a tax haven. If you look at Gibraltar, they have over 24,000 private limited companies registered there, which is an astonishing number for a population of only about 30,000 people. And they also have a very large number, thousands of offshore trusts there. So it is quite clear that Gibraltar remains something of a problem for the Spanish tax authorities, because obviously it's so close to the border and there are so many cross-border flows between Gibraltar and Spain.
Right, and Spain and the UK are both trying to change the rules, actually, so that they can try to tax offshore gambling profits better. The UK's announced some new proposals for rules and sanctions to try to ensure that any kind of remote gambling operators with UK customers will pay UK gambling taxes from next year, no matter where they're based. So it seems like it is possible to take action against tax havens and legislate to tax them.
We've seen a pattern of UK acting in its own interests when it needs to act against tax havens, and the issue of online gambling exemplifies this, because Gibraltar has been hosting a large online gambling industry, which doesn't just apply to UK residents. People across Europe are using these facilities. The UK tends to act unilaterally to preserve its own interests, but importantly doesn't extend this to other countries. So the online gambling industry in Gibraltar is a matter of concern, not only because of loss of tax revenues, also because notoriously online gambling opens up risks around money laundering, and this is a concern for the whole of Europe, actually. But the UK talks about trying to take action against Gibraltar, but by and large, it allows Gibraltar to actually deepen its tax haven facilities rather than tackling the underlying problem.
Right, and I'm just wondering as well, if there's some kind of a consumption tax on gambling that's possible, could they not do the same sort of thing for internet advertising? I'm just thinking of somewhere like Google.
Well, they're quite different things, but in principle, it boils down to the same issue, which is, where does the transaction actually happen? And with both online sales and online gambling, the transaction arguably happens where the mouse is located. In other words, the person who's making the order online makes the contract in his or her own home, and that's where the taxing rights should arise. So there is an overlap there.
Moving on, let's talk about the news that the private sector arm of the British government aid programme, the CDC, has been found to be investing in developing countries through tax havens like Mauritius, the Cayman Islands, Luxembourg, Vanuatu. Why are they using tax havens, just to start off with?
The CDC, which used to be the Commonwealth Development Corporation, has over the last 20 years moved away from its traditional role of funding mainly agricultural development projects in poorer countries. Increasingly, it's moved into funding what I would regard as highly profitable private sector activities, which would probably be able to raise that money on the markets anyway. So that does raise a number of questions. First of all, what are they trying to do and why are they using tax havens? Now, their argument, the reason they give for using tax havens is twofold. First of all, they say that the private investors that they partner with in these investments prefer to use tax havens. Well, you bet they do. Of course they prefer to use tax havens, because they are investing in very profitable activities and they want their own profits to be taxed or untaxed in tax havens. So actually, the CDC is confirming that they're supporting others who use tax havens for their own tax avoidance strategies. But they also say, and I find this very unconvincing, that many countries which they're investing in don't have the legal systems, the rules, regulations, the general social infrastructure that's needed to carry these investments. If that's the case, one has to ask, why are they not actually funding the improvements to the social infrastructure, in other words, improvements to the courts and so on, that are required in order to make these places more viable for investment in the first place? It seems to me they put the cart before the horse. At the end of the day, I think the reason why they're using tax havens like the Cayman Islands and Mauritius is because their private sector partners, the banks and so on, that they're co-investing with, they want to use these tax havens because they're booking their own profits there, and they want to book their profits in places where they aren't taxed. So I think the CDC is demonstrating that actually they are happy to work in conjunction with tax avoiders. And their claims to be wanting to assist the poorer countries are called into question, because it's for me, and I think for most other people, it seems unquestionable that investing in poorer countries in ways which allow the investors to engage in tax avoidance and maybe even tax evasion is not going to be helping the development process. And it's rather sad that CDC, which used to be regarded as one of the most progressive development banking organisations, now has fallen so far behind the curve, because other countries like Norway, Sweden, Belgium, which have similar institutions to CDC, have banned them from using tax havens for investment into poorer countries. So I'm afraid that the British investment arm is way behind the curve here.
Thanks, John. John Christensen, Director of the Tax Justice Network. Now it's time for the TaxCast special feature. Can tax help save the planet? This month, the TaxCast looks at tax and climate change. The threat of climate change to our world and our way of life has taken a bit of a back seat in recent years in the media, but it hasn't gone away, especially for those in developing countries. Remember this?
We, the people, still believe that our obligations as Americans are not just to ourselves, but to all posterity. We will respond to the threat of climate change, knowing that the failure to do so would betray our children and future generations. Some may still deny the overwhelming judgment of science, but none can avoid the devastating impact of raging fires and crippling drought and more powerful storms. The path towards sustainable energy sources will be long and sometimes difficult. But America cannot resist this transition. We must lead it. We cannot cede to other nations the technology that will power new jobs and new industries. We must claim its promise. That's how we will maintain our economic vitality and our national treasure. Our forests and waterways, our croplands and snow-capped peaks. That is how we will preserve our planet.
That's Barack Obama's inaugural speech on his re-election as US president. Nice words. But his and many other governments around the world have neglected a vital missing link when it comes to tackling climate change, the role of tax. In fact, they've got it completely the wrong way round.
It really is contained in that phrase, we've got to make the polluter pay rather than paying the polluter.
Charles Perry used to work for petroleum giant BP. Now he advises companies and organisations on sustainability through his consultancy, Second Nature.
It's quite difficult to get to the bottom of the full picture, which is why they're termed hidden or perverse subsidies, because I don't think anyone really has a clear picture at the moment as to what the picture is for subsidising fossil fuels versus subsidising renewables. But the indication is that on a global scale, it's at least 4 to 5 times more for fossil fuels than it is for renewables.
So let me get this right. Governments around the world are already using taxpayers' money to subsidise technologies we know are damaging the environment and distorting markets in their favour. If you want a recent example, the British government just announced the most generous tax breaks in the world for shale gas extraction through controversial fracking. They also gave North Sea oil and gas producers nearly £2 billion worth of tax breaks in the last financial year. Oh, and at the same time, they cancelled subsidies for solar technology. David Powell of Friends of the Earth.
This is about preserving the way that we've used energy for the last 100 years, about preserving big corporates running our energy supply, centralised oil and gas, which goes into a centralised grid and keeps people locked into high energy bills. We need a completely different way of running our energy system, but this sort of thing is taking us completely down the wrong path. What we need to look at is, how do we use energy as a country? What sort of energy system do we want to have? Are we going to make use of the free renewable resources we've got, or are we going to stick with fossil fuels and all the damage that that will cause?
So some serious choices need to be made by governments, free of financing and lobbying from interested parties and people with conflicts of interest. But we also need to encourage cleaner consumer and corporate behaviour and sends strong signals to business and investors. If we're going to stop paying the polluter and instead make the polluter pay, we need pollution taxes. We need to disincentivise dirtier companies. We need to reflect the true costs of their business. We need incentives, subsidies and tax breaks to cleaner choices. It's Car Free Day on Main Street in Vancouver, Canada, and I'm talking to Dennis Howlett of Canadians for Tax Justice.
The British Columbia government, which is a province in Canada, has implemented a carbon tax since 2008. It is now taxing carbon emissions, mainly in fossil fuels, at a rate of $30 a ton. And the implementation of this carbon tax did overall aim to be revenue neutral so that other taxes were reduced. There was a reduction in the corporate tax, especially more of a reduction for small businesses. And there were reductions on taxes affecting low-income households, increasing some of the rebates that go to low-income households in an effort to make it a more progressive tax. And so the net result is that it actually is contributing to some reduction in poverty, and so that it doesn't create a burden for low-income households to pay a carbon tax. The carbon tax in British Columbia has been actually quite popular. A clear majority support it, and it has been quite effective. British Columbia has had the most success in reducing carbon emissions of any province in Canada. The introduction of the carbon tax was graduated, so it increased by $5 a year per ton, and so it's gone up to $30 a ton now, but it started out lower. So it was quite gradual, and people didn't really notice a big difference in what they have to pay. And a carbon tax is simple and easy. It sends clear market signals, not only to consumers, but also to businesses. So it makes it more attractive to invest in businesses that are going to be environmentally responsible because it builds in the true environmental costs into that. And it clearly makes it more advantageous to invest because there's a better return on environmentally responsible businesses.
Right. And it's not a perfect system, is it? What further steps could be taken, do you think, to expand it to encourage more environmentally responsible behaviour globally?
While it's a very important tool, and I think one of the best tools available for moving forward on greenhouse gas reductions, it, to be most effective, needs to be combined with other things like investment in public transit, other greenhouse gas reducing energy investments, and so on. So it needs to be a combination of things. One weakness of the British Columbia plan is that not enough of the revenue is dedicated to investments in clean energy alternatives. And the other weakness is that the initial anti-poverty measures built into the carbon tax plan in British Columbia were not indexed. And so as time goes on, it's reducing a bit the progressive nature of that tax. The other major problem that people raise is, well, what about trade? And would it not make the price of goods produced by people in British Columbia more costly and so on? But you can adjust for that by having a special import duty that you could apply to goods coming from countries that don't have any carbon reduction plan in place. And you could calculate that fairly easily to say, okay, there is a carbon price added to imported goods that don't come from countries that have reduction targets in place and that are actually following them. If more countries began implementing carbon taxes and apply carbon tariffs on imported goods from irresponsible countries, That would also create a lot more political pressure for a global solution to this. A global carbon tax would also generate potentially a lot of funds needed for investment in supporting carbon reduction plans in developing countries. So far, there has been a global commitment to fund climate mitigation and carbon reduction plans in developing countries, but that money hasn't really materialized in the amounts promised. And that's been one of the big stumbling blocks to global climate negotiations is developed countries say, well, why should we reduce our emissions if China and Brazil and others are going to increase their emissions and will be, you know, worse off? How are we going to pay for all the greenhouse gas disasters that are multiplying around the world? Developed countries need to take some responsibility for that. Flooding, droughts, I mean, all these things are now happening. They're already happening. They're going to get a lot worse. And so globally, we need to take collectively some responsibility for that. The carbon tax could be a way to raise the funds necessary to respond to these disasters that are going to be more and more common.
So tax is good for us.
Well, taxes can be a very useful tool to accomplish a lot of things, not just raise revenue for government, but to send market signals, to change behavior, to raise funds necessary that otherwise aren't going to be there. So it can accomplish a lot of things.
Of course, each country needs to formulate its own greenhouse gas reduction targets and incentives. But don't let your governments forget that tax is a tool they can use to the benefit of the world and the planet. British Columbia in Canada has taken some of the first steps. And don't believe governments who tell you they can't interfere with market forces. They already are subsidising waste and pollution. It's time to stop paying the polluter. Now we need to make the polluter pay. You've been listening to The Taxcast from the Tax Justice Network. For more Taxcasts, you can now find us on iTunes or go to www.tackletaxhavens.com. Thank you.